Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. Mark Smith, President and Chief Executive Officer of the California Healthcare Foundation, and this program is underwritten by the foundation, which you can find at chcf.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Richard Carmona, the 17th U.S. Surgeon General, who served in that post from 2002 to 2006. He is now Vice Chairman of Canyon Ranch and President of the Canyon Ranch Institute. While Dr. Carmona earned his medical degree here at UCSF, his beginnings as a poor Hispanic high school dropout, yes, dropout in New York, and then a decorated veteran of the Vietnam War are quite a contrast to the public health service he took up later in life. After medical school, Dr. Carmona was recruited to start and direct Arizona's first regional trauma care system. He went on to become the chairman of the state of Arizona's Southern Regional Emergency Medical System, a professor of surgery, public health, and family and community medicine at the University of Arizona, and the Pima County Sheriff's Department surgeon and deputy sheriff. In fact, he is one of the most highly decorated police officers in Arizona. His numerous awards include the National Top Cop Award, the National SWAT Officer of the Year, and the National Tactical EMS Award. Dr. Carmona's focus on public health has stemmed from his realization that most of his patients' illnesses and injuries were, in fact, preventable. As Surgeon General, he focused on prevention, preparedness, health disparities, health literacy, and global health to include health diplomacy. He also issued many landmark Surgeon General communications during his tenure, including the definitive Surgeon General's report about the dangers of secondhand smoke. Dr. Carmona will this afternoon, after his prepared remarks, be in conversation with Dr. Robert Maley, president of the David Gladstone Institutes and senior investigator at the Gladstone Institutes of Cardiovascular and Neurologic Disease and professor at the UCSF School of Medicine. My wife tells me it's inappropriate to call anyone an old friend, so please join me in welcoming my friend of long standing, Dr. Richard Carmona.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate the privilege of being with you today at the Commonwealth Club. Mark, thank you for the nice introduction. However, after introductions like that, I often feel like Ricky used to say to Lucy, you got a lot of splaining to do. That doesn't engender a lot of confidence in your peers when they hear the Surgeon General is a high school dropout, Mark. And so some of you obviously are thinking, well, it's just another federal appointee, so nothing to worry about. But just to allay your fears, while in office, I was asked once to give a commencement address among many universities that I do at a high school, which my staff said I didn't have enough time to do. And as it turns out, it was the high school in New York City, DeWitt Clinton High School, and I told them I needed to do it. They fought me and said it was below your station. You really need to stick to bigger things. And I went, and it was fortunate that I went because it was my alma mater, although I didn't graduate. But after my commencement address, they gave me my high school diploma, 37 years late, so now I'm a high school graduate. Well, I'd like to make a couple of comments first. My route to becoming Surgeon General of the United States was quite a circuitous one. And you can't plan to be Surgeon General. The Surgeon General is selected by the President of the United States, confirmed by the Senate. And never in my wildest dreams did I think that this was even possible, because I recall my childhood, my mother, who was an immigrant, my father, who was an immigrant, English as a second language. We're very poor. We grew up in the hood. I was born and raised in Harlem and Washington Heights in New York City. And we've experienced homelessness. My parents had problems with substance abuse. They were good, kind, caring, loving people, but they struggled. And really, that's what shaped my understanding of health in the nation from an early time. Of course, it's all in retrospect because at the time I didn't realize the experiences I was going through and the importance that they would bring to the table as I served as your United States Surgeon General or as I went through my medical school and residency here at UCSF, which provided me the knowledge and the passion to continue to reach out to underserved populations, to serve mankind, and to be a benefit to society in general in everything that I did. I didn't plan to be Surgeon General, as I said, but one of the greatest attributes I think I had in going to Washington to become Surgeon General was being extremely naive, is thinking that I would be different, that I could change the world, that I could stamp out disease and famine and pestilence. I'd stay above the political fray and not get involved with all of that dysfunction that we characterize as Washington. Well, unbeknownst to me, unless you understand this battlefield we call the Beltway, you can't be successful. And so going to Washington with passion, with caring, with all of the knowledge that UCSF imparted on me and all of the wonderful professors and experiences I had in, I think, the best, most diverse medical school in the country, if not the world, I felt fairly well prepared. Now, of course, many of you know I originally trained in general vascular surgery and then subspecialized in trauma burns and critical care. But I am happy to report that I'm a recovering surgeon. I'm not a surgeon any longer. And, it could, you know, when you ask a surgeon to name the best three surgeons in the world, they always have trouble naming the other two. And so public health was a second career for me. But it was the experiences of my childhood and my life that actually helped me understand, once I was well-trained here, was attending for a short while and went and recruited to the University of Arizona and Tucson Medical Center to start the programs down there, after a few years, I started to realize that most of what I was caring for was indeed preventable. Maybe 2 to 3 out of every 4 admissions every single day were for problems that are largely preventable, and that's as the economic and disease burden continue to mount in our society. So being tapped to become Surgeon General happened a few years down the line after I had actually gone back to graduate school and received my master's in public health and policy and administration, not because I intended to be Surgeon General, but I really felt I needed more information to foster improved public health in the communities that I worked in. And although I had a great public health education at UCSF, I felt I needed to broaden that, which I did. Well, going to Washington as Surgeon General is an eye-opening experience. The path there after nomination, then through Senate confirmation, it's an intrusive process. It's one where you become a public figure overnight. And as you move through Senate confirmation, it gets tougher. And some people say even malicious at times because of the partisan politics that is in Washington. Fortunately for me, as I met all of the senators who would ultimately give me the privilege of coming before them in a Senate confirmation hearing, I made a lot of friends and had wonderful discussions, some taking an hour, some several hours. And ultimately then the Senate calls and says, come and on this day at this time, and the Senate will afford you the privilege of a Senate confirmation hearing. I arrived 10 minutes early that day, and I was in a small anteroom outside the U.S. Senate, and I was pacing, diaphoretic, tachycardic, my whole life in front of me. And as I was about to walk in, a very senior senator who had befriended me in the process over those couple of months came out to greet me, thanked me for my willingness to serve my country again in uniform. And I think he was trying to reassure me, but the first words out of his mouth were, Richard, you realize that you're about to go before the most partisan Congress in history. And I said, Senator, I do. He shook my hand and he thanked me again. He had his hand on my shoulder in a very paternalistic way. And he said, it's going to be tough, but you've done well in all of your individual interviews. I think you will do fine in the confirmation. Hang in there. It might get partisan. Just answer honestly as you have. He started to walk away from me. He turned around and walked back at me. And he says, Richard, I have a very good feeling about today, so I want to tell you something. He says, I think you're going to get confirmed, but I'm not certain, but I think you'll get confirmed. I've done this for a long time. I said, okay, Senator, thank you. He says, but I want to give you one bit of information. I said, Senator, anything that you could tell me today to help me get confirmed would be greatly appreciated. He said, no, Richard, it won't help you today. But if you do get confirmed, it will help you in the future. I said, all right, Senator, what is it? He said, calm down, son. He said, you've heard this before, but you can't possibly understand what I'm about to tell you. I said, oh, okay, Senator, tell me. And as I kept prompting him, he kept delaying. And then finally, I said, Senator, what is it? He says, well, Richard, you've heard it before. But when you come to Washington, if you want a friend, you bring a dog. And I said, Senator, I understand. And he looked at me and smiled. He says, Richard, you're clueless. My naivete, which I proudly admit to, which helped me my first couple of years. Well, I went out on the Senate floor, had my confirmation hearing, and in an unprecedented fashion, had a unanimous confirmation after only a few hours. Went and took my job. About 3 years later, I was on the Hill testifying. I think it was at a terrorism committee meeting. And our lives are very scripted. We don't often have the time to chit-chat. Staff brings you in. You talk from 207 to 212. They put you back in the car. You go to another event. You have a new briefing book and so on. But this day, we had a few extra minutes. And the senator happened to be there. And the senator and I started chit-chatting, and there was still time. So I said, Senator, I just want to thank you once again for how kind you've been to me and befriending me and for the mentoring you gave me in going through this process of Senate confirmation. And he said, oh, Richard, you're doing fine as Surgeon General. You've been here a few years with us now. We're proud of you, all of that. And I said, but, Senator, I really want to thank you about your advice. And he looked and smiled, and he said, you mean about the dog? I said, Senator, yes. He said, Richard, he took my hand again, he had my shoulder, and he said, you understand now, don't you? I said, Senator, I do understand, but respectfully, I disagree with you. And he said, how could you disagree? I don't understand. I said, Senator, I've been here a few years now as Surgeon General, and it's come to my opinion that when you come to Washington, if you want a friend, you need to bring two dogs. And he was just mystified. He said, I don't understand. Why? I said, well, Senator, because during your tenure, one of those dogs is going to turn on you. And he smiled and laughed, and he gave me a hug, and he said, can I use that from now on? That's better advice than I gave you. So that's how my life started. And again, my understanding of health is as much from my experiences as a child of not having access to health care, of understanding in a very crude way as a child the socioeconomic determinants of health, experiencing homelessness, experiencing the challenges of living in the street, going to sleep hungry, why I didn't learn, why all of my brothers and sisters never finished school. Because you're trying to survive every day. And those are the same challenges we as a nation face today with good, hardworking families who can't get health care and struggle every day. My mom would cry herself to sleep most nights and tell us in Spanish, I only want to live long enough to see one of my children graduate. She only meant high school because nobody in the family had gotten out of high school. So for me, this is still quite an extraordinary, surreal experience and really one that can only happen in America. And for me to be able to go to UCSF, which was probably the best decision I ever made in my life, and meet wonderful professors like Robert and others who trained me so well and allowed me to go on and appreciate my full potential is truly extraordinary. So as you become Surgeon General, you start to realize that you are walking in the shoes and standing in the shadows of some very important people who came before you. Surgeon General Satcher, my good friend, Surgeon General Koop, and others. And when you look at the history of the Surgeon General of the United States, going back to when President Adams in 1798 founded the Marine Hospital Service, which ultimately became the United States Public Health Service, and you have some of our fine officers here from the U.S. Public Health Service right with us today, who anonymously every day take care of the world with meager resources, and that's nationally our world, but also globally our world, and do a phenomenal job with not nearly the resources that they need on a daily basis to get the job done. So as I start thinking and the clock is ticking and you're living in a fishbowl now and the world is watching because now you are the Surgeon General of the United States, what do you do? So you come up with a portfolio. And that portfolio includes the sum total of all of my life's experiences, but I recognized first and foremost that prevention had to be number one in my portfolio. And the reason was for what I told you in my childhood experiences, as well as all I've learned in the jobs I've had, having been a medic, a soldier, a registered nurse, a physician's assistant, finally getting to medical school, getting through training, advanced training. It was clear to me that the disease burden that we were dealing with as a nation is one that is largely preventable. And at a time when we're spending over 16% of our gross national product on health care, and we start to look at the individual variables or contributors to that disease and economic burden, and you see chronic disease raises its ugly head. And 75 cents of every dollar, of every tax dollar that you all contribute, is spent on chronic disease, much of which is preventable. Think about that. If you were running a business where you were wasting 75 cents of every dollar, the board would fire you and we'd have a new business plan pretty quick. Yet we're still struggling. Most of this challenge is preventable. And as we look at two examples of that, smoking. I'm the 17th Surgeon General of the United States. My predecessor, Luther Terry, in 1964, published the first Surgeon General's report that said, smoking is bad, causes cancer, will kill you. That's four decades ago. I published the 27th and 28th Surgeon General's reports, okay, nearly a half a century later, and we still have tobacco as the number one preventable cause of death in the United States, possibly globally, and cigarettes remain the only product legally available in the United States that, when used as directed, will kill you. And we continue to sell them to people, but we tell our Surgeon General, keep the people healthy. Contradiction right there. It's extraordinary. And so I'm very proud of the last report I issued on secondhand smoke because it's resonated around the world. The epidemiologists at CDC, my epidemiologists, they have told me that it could be one of the most important reports ever released because of the rippling effect it's had globally to reduce tobacco usage. And so when you look at the global burden of disease, national burden of disease, and you look at tobacco, tobacco is that red flag that stands out and says we must do something about this because it permeates all of those chronic diseases that we are speaking of, cardiovascular disease, pulmonary disease, cancers, and so on. And all of it's preventable without the burden of tobacco in society. As we look at the obesity epidemic we have before us today, and I'm just going to give two examples. There are many others, but for the sake of time so we can get into the discussion with Robert, the fact is that we have 9 million children in this country who are overweight or obese. We have unprecedented amount of type 2 diabetes in our children, and we're starting to see hypertension in our children in grammar school. We're taking middle-aged disease and ratcheting it down in a cohort of youngsters who are sedentary, spend far too much time on PlayStations and not enough on the playground, eat indiscriminately, don't have access to the right foods, grow up in single-parent families, latchkey kids, all of the terminology that we use, that we understand the social determinants of health, which are so important and inextricably intertwined with the health of the nation. You can't fix the health problem until you deal with the socioeconomic determinants of health. They have to be done in tandem. If you do one or the other, it's not going to advance the health significantly of the nation and therefore will not decrease the disease and economic burden that we experience in the nation. So as I look at the childhood obesity epidemic, and it was tough to get traction on that. Let me tell you, my predecessor, David Satcher, started, and it was tough. I picked up the baton from him when I took over office from David, and we struggled to get traction because at a time when we're at war, at a time when there's so many competing interests, obesity really isn't a sexy thing. But I had to be smart as Surgeon General, and I started learning that it wasn't always about the science, it's how you spin that science. So when you present childhood obesity as an issue of itself from science, sometimes falls on deaf ears. Now it's beginning to resonate. But when I, one day at a press conference, so frustrated because everybody wanted to talk about anthrax and terrorism, and a reporter inadvertently in a room this size filled with reporters said to me, well, Surgeon General, what is the most challenging problem you're facing? Of course, this is after 9/11 and anthrax. I said, obesity. Dead silence. Nobody knew what to ask me. And they said, why? I said, because it's the terror within. That resonated. Got in every paper. Surgeon General says this is a terror and equated it to terrorism. But I says it is because obviously we need to take action against our enemies for bad things that have happened and all of that. I said, but I'm telling you, 9 million children today are overweight or obese, and they, in fact, are deteriorating before your eyes. And I said, there are workforce implications here. We're worried now in the Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, Marines. Where are we going to get our soldiers and sailors in the future? Where will our firemen and policemen come from that are first responders that take care of us every day? When I'm telling you, this generation could be the unhealthiest in history. And my epidemiologist had told me at the time, Surgeon General, this could be the first generation of children in the United States that lives less than its parents unless we do something about this. So think about that disease burden, which in the next decade is estimated to be at 20%, over $4 trillion spent of gross national product. So think about that, and then think about the workforce implications. And what you start to see is as the disease burden with chronic disease mounts, preventable disease, that the legacy we are going to leave our children if we don't break this pattern is unsustainable. Our children will not be able to afford health care. They will be sicker. They will live less. And we will have huge workforce implications within society. And this is at a time when we're trying to recognize the importance of diversity, cultural competence. We want more leaders to have black and brown skin. We want Native Americans to be up there too. Yet, when we look at the socioeconomic determinants that are inextricably tied to their health status, they drop out of school at 30, 40, 50%. So where are you going to get the leaders in the future if you can't get them out of high school? So throwing dollars, federal, state, or otherwise, to try and save somebody at 18 or 19 or 20 works once in a while. The real key is how do you provide sustainability in the environment that these children grow in, that they get food, that they get nurturing, that they get mentoring, that they have a stable environment, that they're not worried about where they're going to live the next day, then they can learn. Then those children who we lose every day have an opportunity to be successful. But we have to understand that. One of the organizations that I chair nationally, the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease, made up of over 110 organizations, is trying to deal with this issue and get it on the national policy with our presidential aspirants as well as others. That is, we're tired of the platitudes of all of those people who aspire to higher office at any level, including the presidency, where they all have a solution to give you universal care, or universal coverage, and they're going to do this and they're going to pay for that. Those are all economic debates. If we continue to argue solely the economics of health care, it's predictable it's going to cost more every year and there's going to be more disease. So until we figure out a good business plan that's coupled to a very passionate, strong commitment to prevention, disease burden and economic burden will continue to mount. So the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease, which I chair, is that organization which is attempting to do that now. I also spend a lot of time after prevention on preparedness issues. Preparedness issues, of course, are intertwined with health. Now, you may not think so. We're at war. We have anthrax. We have all these problems that I've spoken of. But a nation that is not healthy cannot be prepared. If you don't have healthy soldiers and sailors and policemen and firemen and EMS people to prevent terrorism, to respond to terrorism, to mitigate and recover from terrorism, your nation will never prosper and will be weak. So health is inextricably intertwined to national security. And I got that to resonate because I thought we have to start selling health a different way because it's not resonating with the people who are in the positions to make differences as it relates to policy and funding of these programs. So a nation at war, not only the issue of intertwined health with national security, but having to work with my colleagues to educate people about weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, and basically educating all of our first responders as to this new world order of weapons of mass destruction and terrorism and what they need to do to be prepared. If you will, renew the old civil defense mentality into the 21st century, which is what we need to do. Third area after prevention, preparedness, was health disparities that I spent a lot of time in. Because as you know from my background, this was not merely an academic pursuit. It was one that I saw contributed significantly to the disease and economic burden in society, as well as one that I experienced firsthand, which, quite frankly, if not informed me, biased me as to having to do something about this extraordinarily glaring problem in our society that gets worse and worse and worse as we go along. Health disparities are not an African-American problem or a Native American problem or Hispanic problem. They are an American problem. These are all American citizens. Some of the worst health disparities in our nation are not in Harlem where I grew up or not in the South Bronx or in East L.A. They're on our Indian reservations. They're in Indian country. And you go into those reservations where our U.S. Public Health Service serves so bravely because no one else will go to those places to serve. It's your U.S. Public Health Service that does that. One of our responsibilities when I was Surgeon General. You go to those reservations, and if you forget for a moment you're in the United States, you look at the health metrics, you'll think you're in a third world country. maternal child mortality, suicide rates, mental health problems. That is a huge burden on society. And there's a social injustice that's occurring as well. But if for no other reason, there's an economic burden that's being created that should force us to act appropriately to rescue these once vibrant societies that are perishing now in desolate surroundings in places we call reservations. That's where health disparities are most greatly manifested. While Surgeon General, I also spent a considerable amount of time trying to foster the concept of health diplomacy. We're a nation at war. Simple force projection that we're most powerful doesn't get you most places. You can't force people into a democracy. You can't force people to look at your views just because you're the strongest guy. But one of the powers that we have in this nation that remains significantly unleveraged is the power of what I call health diplomacy, doing some of the things that we do best. Now, mind you, I was a soldier in combat. I understand. I was wounded. I lost friends in battle. I understand the inequities of war, and I understand sometimes you have to fight. What I'm saying is we have more power than that. And so as we export, as we project a softer force of humanitarianism, we've seen it work. When our U.S. Public Health Service, Peace Corps, USAID people, Navy, other services were sent to the tsunami victims in Indonesia, with countries where terrorism was rampant, and people didn't want us there. But after months, they didn't want us to leave because they saw the spirit of the true American. And we delivered health care to improve the health of those communities, water, sanitation, general public health. But in doing so, we changed the opinions of a country as to who we really are. And there was a trust regained when that happened. Health diplomacy is a huge adjunct to our foreign policy that needs to be leveraged much more strongly globally in order to eradicate the asymmetries that lead to terrorism. Differences in ideology, theology, economics. Once we're embedded there and they see how we are and they see we are just fellow humans who have a little bit better life at this time, but we're willing to work with them, a lot of those asymmetries go away. When those asymmetries go away, there is no reason for divisiveness. It's a new playing field at that time. So I advocate strongly that this needs to be part of our foreign policy and leveraged even more than it has been because it's hardly used today. My post-Surgeon General journey to Kent after being Surgeon General is a unique one. I didn't plan to go to Canyon Ranch, which, as many of you know, is the number one health and wellness facilities in the world. It's a global corporation that has the brand, if you will, recognition in health and wellness and prevention long before anybody was talking prevention. Mel Zuckerman and Enid Zuckerman and the owners and founders back in the 70s had this idea that we needed to move our nation in a direction that was expressed in health and wellness. Optimal health and wellness through prevention, which I've known them for years, but I didn't plan to go back there. But when they heard that I was leaving office and they called and said, come talk to us, I thought Mel and Jerry were just being paternalistic, as they always were, trying to be my friends and giving me advice of where I should go. I was looking to go back in academics. I had opportunities to go in business world, and it's a wonderful opportunity, you know, great, great America, wonderful opportunities before you after serving as Surgeon General. So I went and spoke to my colleagues at Canyon Ranch, and they said, well, why don't you consider coming to work for us? And I said, well, what would a Surgeon General do at the spa? And they said, well, you understand, that's only one aspect. We have a global corporation here that's about health and wellness and prevention. I said, I do, but here's the problem. I love you guys, and I know what you're doing is right, and the rest of the nation should have access to this. But my fellow Surgeon Generals and I have made a commitment to continue being involved in health disparities and moving forward national and global health policy and health and security issues for the nation. So Surgeon General Coops, Satcher, Novello, Elders, all of us have made that commitment to work individually and collectively, when necessary, to improve the status of health in the United States and globally. So Mel said to me, well, we knew you were going to say that, so just want to let you know we have a Canyon Ranch Institute. We've endowed that with a lot of money for you. You're going to be the president if you come here, and basically you can do anything you want with this institute to improve the health and wellness of any group you want in the country. So I said, well, you know, I had another excuse. I said, well, but I really want to go back into academics, and the university has wanted me to come back as a professor. He said, we knew you'd want that too. We've endowed the first distinguished professorship for you at the University of Arizona. And so if you take the job as our vice chairman and CEO, you'll have that. And not only do we want you to have the institute, we are going to expect and mandate that you go out and take these health best practices around the world to underserved communities and make the health of this nation and the world better because that's one of the reasons we're hiring you. And I then said, well, but, and he says, and finally he got frustrated with me. He says, Richard, don't you understand? You can come here and continue to work as Surgeon General with the difference of, unlike the federal government, we'll support you and pay you well. I said, okay, I'll sign up. And I did. And it's been a wonderful experience. We're in many underserved communities around the country through our Canyon Ranch Institute. We're partnering with large and small organizations, and we're making a difference in the health of the underserved. We're dealing with health and safety and security issues through our institute. So it's been a very positive experience. In closing, I will tell you that we, the citizens of the world, are inextricably united in this global economy, in a world that seems to shrink every year, with almost 7 billion people trying to inhabit this space. That seems to be a shrinking space. As we and other nations have experienced, the concept of superpower is once again evolving and being redefined, just as it was in the 19th century, from European dominance to American dominance in the 20th century, and now the 21st century, with China, India, the EU, and others nipping at our heels. I believe the superpower of the 21st century will be determined not by traditional military force projection or geopolitics, but rather by those who find global solutions to the diverse world challenges before us. We, the United States, have the opportunity to take the lead, to be uniters for global health disparities, global social determinants of health, environmental and economic challenges, and more. Affect the health, safety, and security of not only our nation, but affect the health, safety, and security of the world, which is at stake at this time. If we succeed in redefining this concept of superpower, we will not only improve the global health, safety, and security, but in doing so, may have regained the trust, respect, and admiration of a world yearning for global leadership. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thanks. Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Carmona. I'm Dr. Robert Maley, the president of the J. David Gladstone Institutes and a senior investigator at the Gladstone Institutes of Cardiovascular Disease and Neurological Disease, and a professor at UCSF. I don't need to tell you that because you were one of my students.
Yes, sir.
And I'm delighted to be here to moderate this conversation with you. You've shared with us and you've actually inspired us with the early aspects of your life and your upbringing on the streets and all that we've heard now. But what do you think gave you the drive to succeed as you have when so many people, it's easy to give up? What is your message for us?
Well, I think there were critical junctures in my life where mentors emerged and guided me when I was stumbling, which happened many times. Mm-hmm. But I would have to attribute most of the success really to the most important early women in my life, my grandmother, my abuelita, who spoke no English, who came to the country with her family so that they could appreciate opportunity, which she didn't have, and my mother, who was a self-taught woman and struggled through life with her own personal problems but never forgot her children. And even with no money, she'd go to the library and she'd bring home books and she'd make us read and she'd everything from mythology to history. And she'd always tell us, this is your currency. This is your ticket out. Get an education and take advantage of all this country has to offer. So I think it was a combination of things, mentors at the right time, people willing to help me when I stumbled, and a good foundation of parents, grandparents who wanted us to succeed.
Great. Thank you. We have a number of questions with respect to more information about your role as Surgeon General. And what are the greatest rewards in that job? What were the greatest challenges? And would you do it again?
Oh, boy. The greatest rewards, well, I think all of you would understand, is that we all, at some point in our life, are frustrated and want to do something bigger and better than ourselves, and we want to change the world. We want to do something that's bigger. And so here is a job as Surgeon General of the United States, which is such a credible position, where now you're there, be careful what you ask for, because everybody's watching, and now you have the opportunity to make the world a better place. And I think that's the most gratifying part, that every day you get up and it's just, what can I do today to improve the health, safety, and security of the nation? What can I do to protect the legacy of the Office of the Surgeon General and honor the work that has been done before me by the Surgeon Generals who came before me? The greatest challenge as Surgeon General was politics and political barriers and understanding that the business of Washington is politics, not health, and figuring out how to navigate that very difficult, at times dysfunctional, at times treacherous environment to move appropriate issues forward on behalf of the American public. Because the Surgeon General of the United States is not the Surgeon General of a political party, either left or right. The Surgeon General of the United States is the doctor of the people, and you speak for the people. And that's why the Surgeon General is such a credible figure, not only nationally, but globally, because no Surgeon General has ever tarnished the office of the Surgeon General. All Surgeon Generals speak with authority and authenticity because they speak with the best science that the public needs, not any theology or ideology or some other construct. And for all of the times that we've had in our, you know, in society where our government has failed us, the Surgeon Generals have always stepped up and done extraordinary things that have had magnanimous benefit to the health, safety, and security of the nation and the world.
I know, speaking for our audience, we appreciate very much what you did as Surgeon General. Dr. Carmona, we spend so much money on health care in the United States, and yet survey after survey indicates that we are far from the healthiest nation in the world. Why is that?
Well, it's really saddening to look at the metrics where, in general, when we look at health metrics for the United States, somewhere between 25th and 40th we fall, depending on which metric you look at, you know, life expectancy, maternal child health, vaccination rates, all of those things. Yet we outspend any other nation by so much money, it's embarrassing. There's a lot of reasons for it, and, you know, certainly my colleagues have done a lot of research in this to look to the variables that contribute to some areas of our nation that improve with health. Certainly our scientific community is extraordinary, but what they end up doing is overcoming the bad behaviors that are causing the bad health. So as I said earlier, people continue to smoke. They drink excessively. They become sedentary as they get older. They eat indiscriminately. They practice other unhealthy behaviors or habits. So when you look at the chronic disease burden in society and you see, well, what contributes to it, you keep coming back to bad behaviors. People that are doing things that if they eliminated, we wouldn't have this problem. So yes, guys like Robert and other researchers do extraordinary things to help us reverse atherosclerosis because we've eaten the wrong diet all our life and we've been sedentary, okay? And we haven't taken the appropriate precautions to pursue optimal health and wellness through prevention as we advocate at Canyon Ranch and our Canyon Ranch Institute. And so what we really need to do is engender, all of us, a cultural transformation of this nation that allows us to pursue, passionately pursue, optimal health and wellness through prevention while still having the best medical care system in the world. But let's not fool ourselves. We don't have a health care system today. This is a sick care system. A health care system would have an infrastructure that would reward all of our professionals to keep you healthy, and they would be evaluated in how they kept you healthy. And the healthiest community would be evaluated differently. We hope that in the future, the most successful emergency rooms are the ones that close because there's no more emergencies, because we've prevented all of those problems. That's the optimal path that we need to be on as a nation.
We know that there are a number of barriers to healthcare delivery, and let's go through a few of them one at a time. One that you learned about as a young boy was culture and language. What are the issues, and how are we doing in overcoming those?
One of the greatest barriers that I found as Surgeon General in trying to improve the health, safety, and security of the nation, which is a statutory responsibility of the Surgeon General, was that not that I lacked science to do it. I had, jokingly, I should say, I have the best Rolodex in the world. I mean, because the U.S. Public Health Service has some of the greatest minds in the world, and NIH, CDC, SAMHSA, HRSA, and then you know, because of my relationship at UC and other universities. I could pick up the phone and speak to the world's expert. And there were many times I didn't know what the best path was, and I wanted to get the best science right then at that moment. I pick up the phone, and one of the great things about being Surgeon General, when you call, people return your phone call right away. And I would get the right information, but we increasingly found the challenge wasn't the science. The challenge was taking the science, the best science that the world has ever known, and packaging it in a culturally competent manner, delivering it to diverse populations that we have the privilege to serve, to do one thing only, change behavior. Walk a little more, don't smoke, don't drink excessively, eat less, eat healthier foods, make better choices, wear a seatbelt, wear a helmet. That's the problem, because the science doesn't change. The application of the science to the diverse populations in the delivery changes, and that's what cultural competence is. It isn't simply getting an interpreter. It's really putting yourself in the shoes of those you serve and understanding how they see health and wellness and working with them through cultural barriers between us to engender empowerment that allows them to make those changes. And the U.S. Public Health Service really does that best, because the best experience for that in our nation is in the Indian nations that we have the privilege to work with. And our U.S. Public Health Service has been there since the beginning, and they are experts in cultural competence because of that.
Mm-hmm. Certainly one of the largest barriers to health delivery is the economic factors. And actually most of our questions, or many of our questions, are about the health care insurance programs. Our presidential candidates are discussing the need for these, and there are several questions. One is, what do you think would be the most effective reform in our health care system in the United States?
Robert, I think that it's a complex question, and we're used to hearing people talk in sound bites, especially with the media the way it is. So people talk in terms of universal care, universal payer. I mean, those are all clever cliches, but they don't address the issue. The issue, one of the main issues I addressed for you already, is that we have chronic disease that's largely preventable. So if you just keep addressing this as a business plan, who's going to pay, then we all just pay more. We should just get used to that. And we will be sicker over time, even though extraordinary science is trying to fight off the disease burden that we willingly put on because of our behaviors. What needs to be done is to accept the fact that we're not going to be able to do this in one administration. We need to get leaders that are going to step up and say, guys, it's taken you a half a century to get here. It's going to take a while, because this is a cultural transformation. It's not one program. It's not one business plan. We have to change the way our nation views optimal health and wellness. We need to put in place a payer system, an infrastructure that rewards professionals for keeping us healthy while still having the services there that we need when people are sick. There's no question. We need to change the way we educate our children. We need to start with the old-fashioned home economics in school and teach kids about just general health, good food, exercise, things like that. The interesting thing in the solution for this healthcare crisis, most of the problems are very simple public health endeavors that don't require rocket science. They don't require a lot of expense, but they do require bridging the most difficult barrier we have, which is one of comfort in our culture, which is a culture of excess. We have to start dealing with this, or the legacy we're about to leave our children is unsustainable.
As you look around the world, which nation do you think has a plan, an insurance plan or a health delivery plan, that's worthy of our consideration?
Well, I think there's several, and I would say right up front, there's no one that's adoptable. And the reason I say that is, all of these plans have arisen in countries that have unique cultures, and they are different than ours. As Surgeon General, I would often have people in meetings like this say, well, why don't you just adopt the Canadian plan? I mean, look how well they do. I'd say, they do well in a lot of things. You're right. But let me ask you, would you be willing to wait 6 months or a year for your hernia operation? And the formulary is going to be quite restricted. You know all those drugs you take? Only 1 in 10 is on that formulary, so you won't be able to have that. And when you start to see the restrictions that are placed on the system, most Americans, you know, stand up and say, I wouldn't do that. I'm an American. Because Americans want everything yesterday, and they don't want to pay. Okay? And so the culture that America has become used to since post-World War II, with the way we give health care out through the employers and other methods and Medicare and Medicaid is it's one almost that this is an entitlement. And so until we start to change the culture, then no plan will really be acceptable because we really have the carte blanche gold plan in this country, except for 50 million people who are falling out now because of the uninsurance problem. So when I look at Sweden, when I look at the Scandinavian countries, when I look at Canada, there's a number of countries you can look at and you can see parts of their system you'd like to take best practices and say this might work. None of them will work until we spend enough time improving the health literacy of the United States, which the literature tells us a third of us are health illiterate. So until such time that we improve the health literacy to a point where the American public understands that part of the problem is of their own doing and that there are solutions within their reach no matter what economic strata you are, with government coming in with an appropriate infrastructure to reward people to be healthy and so on and so forth, then we can bring best practices together and over time turn back this health care crisis. But it's going to take all of us as a nation, 300 million people buying into this. It's going to be incremental change over time, and it's going to be an intergenerational endeavor. It's not going to be done in one administration. Can't be.
You've brought up the topic of science literacy. And as a nation, I believe we are becoming illiterate.
Yes, sir.
With respect to science and health matters. Why is this? Who is failing? Is there a role for media? What should we be doing about this?
Robert, that's a very important question, especially now since my colleagues and I, especially in the recent past, have been debating the socioeconomic determinants of health. You know, the greatest indicator of health status in the nation and the world is socioeconomic status, and that's inextricably tied to educational level as well. So the less education you have, the more likely you are to smoke. The poorer you are, the more likely you are to smoke. And when you look at other variables, you start seeing that as that lower strata, socioeconomic strata of the nation, gets larger because of the challenges we have, the people that need the care the most and prevention are getting further and further away from it. And so the disease burden and the economic burden mounts. So as we look at what is needed to the future, the challenges, that is, that are before us. The issue of health disparities is an extraordinarily important one that we have to face. Martin Luther King told us many decades ago that something to the effect that the evil twin of racial discrimination is health discrimination. And the data clearly shows that we are a nation divided by our health metrics and ethnicity. So if you're Hispanic or African American or Native American, likelihood is you will have less access to health care, your outcomes will be poorer, you won't get the drugs you need, and the list is endless. Ultimately, we all pay for that particular problem. So we should all be outraged that in the greatest nation of the world that there are still haves and have-nots within our nation that continue to fall behind as others move ahead.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. We're talking with Dr. Richard Carmona, the 17th Surgeon General of the United States, who served from 2002 to 2006. Dr. Carmona, you've been quoted as saying that the death knell for health care would be a government program that provides equal medical care for all, regardless of lifestyle choices. Would you say more about what you mean by that, and how would you draw the line to make sure the right people are being served?
What I meant in that is that if we simply continue to pay for health care without making other changes, that we will all pay more every year as we go on. We will see more health disparities. We will see more challenges. Diabetes, obesity will go up. Children will be sicker. All of that. The idea is to put in a new infrastructure with a thorough understanding that this is a cultural transformation and an economic base that now incentivizes people to stay healthy, incentivizes providers to spend more time with you, because for the practitioners in there, in the room, or you patients, how many of you can sit down with your doctor for half an hour, an hour, and just kind of chew the fat and say, help me through this, doc, what's going on here? Or a nurse. And so, but we won't spend that money up front to keep you healthy. But when your arteries get clogged and you have a myocardial infarction and you need revascularization, we'll spend $100,000, $150,000 to make you better. It doesn't make a lot of sense. We have more than enough scientific information to tell us that we really need to right-size this system and couple any changes that we make in the system of infrastructure to support our citizens with a commitment from the citizens that they will work with us to try and stay healthy as much as they can, which means no smoking, no drinking excessively, wear a helmet, wear a seatbelt, engage in some physical activity every day, on and on and on. And most of that chronic disease burden will go down in time. There will be much more money in the system, and we will have more quality and quantity of life while reducing the cost of health care. That's the ideal situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have some questions on specific health and wellness issues. One relates to children. Could you say more about the Year of the Healthy Child that you initiated, and what are the important elements, and how are we progressing?
Well, I thank you for that. That was a program near and dear to my heart. As Surgeon General, I had made a commitment with my team to do something concentrated over the year. Not that we didn't do it in all our years, but we said, this year, let's target childhood health metrics. Vaccines, nutrition, education, all of these issues. And we pushed as hard as we could in partnership with education, with other departments, with state health departments. And I would pick usually the most underserved school that we could find in every state as a representative school. I'd go there, spend the day, go through the lunch line with the kids, and we'd make a big media event out of it. And working with the local health departments and state health departments to try and engender this cultural transformation. And as you went through, I mean, this was early on in my career as Surgeon General, you'd go through the lunch line and you start to see, well, gee, I understand why we have so much obesity here. And when you get through the lunch line, then there's all of the candy and soda machines that they pile onto this. So, you know, some of these kids are getting 2,000-3,000 calories at lunchtime. And yet they're sedentary because the school's eliminated physical activity because we don't need that anymore, right? I mean, the kids get plenty of time to play outside. Wrong. Unintended consequences of that policy 20, 30 years ago are now being appreciated as contributing to this obesity epidemic. So that the Year of the Healthy Child aimed to look at all of the risk factors that children were still burdened with that don't allow them to appreciate their full potential, and then to start to raise the health literacy of the nation as to how to do that so that each child has the opportunity to appreciate their full potential, at least through the health and socioeconomic indicators as best we could.
We have another question related to children, and that's immunizations. And more parents are declining to have their children immunized. What is your opinion on this topic, and would you also extend it to immunization and autism?
Sure. As Surgeon General, and even more recently, I chair a national coalition for childhood vaccination through the National Foundation for Infectious Disease, where we work with a number of organizations with the idea to foster maximizing vaccination to all of our children. Vaccines have been one of the bellwether events in public health in the 20th century. I mean, we don't have polio anymore. For those of you who are my age or older, every mom's worry was baby's going to get polio. We don't have polio anymore. You don't see a whole lot of pertussis or whooping cough or tetanus because of vaccines. Vaccines are the most cost-effective way to guarantee public health in your communities. Because of some bad publicity, because of some isolated events which people have attributed to the vaccine, we now have groups that are saying, I'm not going to immunize my child. That's deleterious to your child's health, but it's also deleterious to community health because that child could become a vector for disease within the community. And so we do all we can to try and improve the health literacy around vaccines because other than minor problems with the vaccine, problems, I mean, my arm hurts, you get a little bit of a fever, something like that, they're all transient and self-limiting. As Surgeon General, I say the same thing that as I say now with my position as chair of the National Foundation for Infectious Disease Childhood Vaccination Program and others, every parent should be encouraged to maximally vaccinate their children for all vaccinatable diseases because that's good. The autism issue has come up when I was a Surgeon General, and we immediately convened a number of scientific groups to study that. Not only the federal government, we brought in the experts from universities around the country and said, tell us, is there a connection? There is no scientific connection. All of the information was anecdotal. Not that we don't hurt for those people whose children get autism and it's a terrible thing, and they struggle through life, and it's a tremendous burden on the family and the society. But I would have no vested interest in not revealing that right away to right that situation to make our children healthy, as my colleagues would. So we searched. We brought all the people together, and since that time, there's been a number of consensus groups brought together. And every scientist has said there is no statistical correlation here. It's not causing autism. Encourage parents to immunize their children against all vaccinatable disease.
There's a question with respect to HIV and AIDS. And the question is, as a nation, we've spent large sums of money for vaccine development, but they have been unsuccessful. What is your comment? Are we close?
Well, you know, my good friend and colleague, former U.S. Public Health Service Officer Tony Fauci, running that office at the NIH, and has some of the most brilliant scientists in the world and collaborates with some of the best scientists in universities all over the country. I think that the HIV virus has been proving to be a very complex opponent. It's not for lack of trying in putting the best scientists together. I think what Robert's referring to is just recently they've abandoned the vaccine trial because it was failing, and in fact there were some subgroups that it looked might even be deleterious to their health. And that's not to suggest that these people aren't doing the best they can. But I know Dr. Fauci is in the near term going to be reconvening a group of esteemed scientists nationally, globally on this issue to ask them, is there a better path? Should we be putting more money in another area of development? Prevention, clearly, we have to spend much more time and money in. But as far as vaccines and the science behind the virology and how we would do this, he's asking for help from his colleagues around the world. So I think they're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. But Robert, as you know, as a leader globally in having us understand atherosclerosis and lipids over the years, that takes years and years and years sometimes to come to that. As I said, when I started medical school, there was a young NIH researcher, Dr. Robert Miller, who was at UCSF, who we first learned about lipoproteins. And 25, 30 years later, we're still learning more about lipoproteins.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's correct. There are questions related to health care issues for the aging population. Mm-hmm. And one is, I'll refer to it as brain health. And there's fear, of course, with an aging population developing Alzheimer's disease. Is there anything that we can do?
Well, there's a number of studies. In fact, just this week I saw some new literature on the whole issue of the plaques that form in Alzheimer's and how we're getting a better understanding as to cause and effect. But there are general things that we can do as we age to keep our brain health. In fact, at one of the areas we're working on in Canyon Ranch is with UCSF researchers, Dr. Mike Persenick, mm-hmm. In brain health. The concept of neuroplasticity, we understand now, as opposed to when I went to medical school, that senior citizens can continue to learn throughout their life. When I was a young doc in the 70s over here and 80s in training, it was kind of like, well, you know, when you get to 60, you don't really have much capacity to do much anymore. And, you know, your kids were ready to put you out to pasture. And fortunately for me, that has changed. So my kids are going to spare me. But the point is that Mike Merzenich, who was one of my neurophysiology professors here at UCSF, has done some extraordinary work over 4 decades. And that work has demonstrated that neuroplasticity, or the making of new neural connections in the brain, continues throughout your lifespan. And the more that you challenge yourself mentally and physically, because physical activity increases the neural networks as well as mental activity. And now there is a posit brain science program that we're looking at and working with them on that's already available commercially that's been tested and scientifically validated to show that through the appropriate structured educational experiences and physical experiences, as you age, even into your 80s and 90s, you can continue to make new neural networks and offset some of the deterioration that normally occurs with age. So I think that's wonderful information for our senior citizens.
Certainly is. And what is your assessment of the way we're handling our servicemen and women coming back from the Iraq War? Are they being cared for appropriately?
My sense is, Robert, that people in charge, the military folks that I work with, the Army, Navy, Air Force Surgeon Generals, and others, are really, really working hard to try and do the best they can. Some of the things that I saw from the inside was there was a great underestimation of the need for mental health care and physical care because after all, the thought was that this war was going to end very quickly. Hmm. And so we find 6 years later that we have thousands and thousands of young men and women that will be physically disabled for life, and some of them will have mental health problems for life. And it's our obligation, it's our duty to provide them with the best health care that this nation has. And as I told my staff, my opinion is, you know, if the beds are full at the military hospital, then you go pay for beds in a civilian hospital. And if those beds are full, then you go turn a hotel into a hospital, because we put these young men and women into harm's way. There should be no barriers for them receiving the total, comprehensive, integrated care that they need, whatever it is. Mm. And that's my opinion.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that comment. You were part of an administration that restricted scientists from generating new embryonic stem cells.
And I beg your pardon?
I'm just reading the question, sorry. As a result, much innovative research actually left the United States. What's your personal opinion, mm-hmm. and can we recover?
I'll start with the last part. Yes, we can recover, and I think we're starting to, albeit slowly. You have to understand that the rhetoric that you heard, which was largely ideologically and theologically driven, if we use stem cells as an example, which I think is what you're referring
yes.
to,
yes.
If you look at my opinions throughout the time, they were very clear. The use of stem cells holds great potential to do a lot of good things in our health system. And so I would reject the thesis that that was my opinion. My opinions were always very clear as it related to science, because as a Surgeon General of the United States, I only spoke of science. I didn't speak of politics other than the politics that obstructed my ability to speak of science. Okay? So that there's no question that stem cells, we need to harness that energy for the betterment of society because of a Congress, an administration who had a different ideological or theological approach, we weren't able to do that for a while. But what's happened is, yes, some of it's gone offshore, but don't forget, many states have just gone ahead and done the research, because all it did was restrict federal dollars for those stem cells. So UCSF is a perfect example where we have the stem cell program, and the governor, a Republican governor, said, no, we're going to give you money, and we want you to do research. So it actually cut across political lines, and other states have done the same thing. So I was very happy that I was seeing my fellow colleagues and scientists say, we're going to move this forward, because it does have merit. And, you know, that's the problem. The Surgeon General addresses the science of the nation, the science that the nation needs to improve its health, safety, or security. The people you elect tell you about the politics of that decision. But the Surgeon General should always be able to speak to you honestly and clearly and forthrightly on any issue that involves science as it relates to the health, safety, or security of the nation without concerns for political impediments.
Thank you. Let's go back to a personal question. You were trained at UCSF under some of the really great trauma surgeons.
Yes.
What was that experience like, and what were the lasting medical lessons that you learned?
Oh, that's a great question. I love it. I mean, every rotation I did at at UCSF, you know, at Mount Zion, at the private hospitals in town, at San Francisco General, the VA, I really took a special caring for San Francisco General, being that, you know, I used to think those are my people. That's kind of where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And so I would do every rotation I could at San Francisco General. I was fortunate that when I went into surgery, my mentor through medical school and residency was Don Trunke.
Yes.
And Robert Lim, who are two of the most prestigious trauma surgeons in the world. And I trained with them, and I did my NIH fellowship in trauma burns and critical care at San Francisco General. And not only learned about the science of medicine and surgery, but I learned about humanity. I learned about the cultural competence necessary to be able to care for people. I learned about the value of the touch, the bedside manner, the healing ability you have by just expressing that cultural competence with diverse populations that you have the privilege to serve. That so-called doctor-patient relationship that, You can't quantify. There's no book that tells you it's 5 or 10%. But every one of us knows that if you can make the connection with that patient, no matter how ill they are, they get better a little faster. Something happens that's different. And it's one of the many variables that contribute to healing. And I've never seen it practiced any better than at San Francisco General Hospital and UCSF.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one more question. We have many more, as you can see here. But one last question, Dr. Carmoni. Could you tell us, if you could do one thing with a wave of your hand, no political restrictions or anything, to promote wellness in the United States, what would that be?
Well, the first thing I was going to say was to eliminate political restrictions. But if that's already eliminated, then I think that would be to engender a cultural transformation whereby the health literacy is so raised that our citizenry, 300 million people, demand pursuit of optimal health and wellness through prevention activities. And we have an infrastructure to support them, and we start moving our nation in that direction. I think that would be the best thing that we can do because it changes health metrics, it reduces health costs, it makes people happier, it improves morale. It's all of the right things. And tying on to another question that you asked me earlier was, you know, about being Surgeon General, would I go back? I think every Surgeon General faces that. And with the right president, with the right administration, and now knowing the right questions to ask when I started the office, sure, I think I would because, again, how many of us get the opportunity to change the world? And this is a wonderful position that has been unscathed for over 200 years, and it has always served the best interest of the American public in spite of political challenges over that period of time.
Our thanks to Dr. Richard Carmoni, the 17th Surgeon General of the United States, serving from 2002 to 2006. Vice Chairman of Canyon Ranch and President of Canyon Ranch Institute. This program is generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Dr. Robert Maley, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed your comment.